ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty of sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick with you. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National.
This special news bulletin from the ABC is read by Peter Young. Mr. Whitlam has been dismissed by the Governor-General and Mr. Malcolm Fraser will become caretaker Prime Minister of Australia pending a general election.
The Governor-General of Australia do, by this my proclamation, dissolve the Senate and the House of Representatives.
It's the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam by Governor-General Sir John Kerr, an event that more than any other exposed and tested the architecture of Australia's constitution.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
So, what does the dismissal tell us about our political institutions?
This was Australia's most significant constitutional crisis. In fact, I think you would say Australia's most significant political crisis.
Professor George Williams is the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Western Sydney. He's one of Australia's leading constitutional law experts. George, how significant an earthquake was the dismissal?
Earthquake is the right word. It was an event without parallel at the national level in Australia, and of course it led to the destruction of the Whitlam government, which itself was a bold, reforming, brash government. And it marks a political event that, of course, even all these decades later, still looms large in our political consciousness.
And George, what tension did it expose in the architecture of Australia's government?
Well, it's most basic tension. It's that an elected government, elected by the people, was deposed by an unelected official, the Governor-General, who is the Queen's, at that point, representative in Australia. And it raised basic questions about our identity, our independence from the Crown of the United Kingdom, and what it meant to have a democratically elected government removed by someone who was an appointed official.
And the Governor-General removed the Prime Minister by exercising the reserve powers of the Crown, which were being exercised by the Crown's representative in Australia, the Governor-General. We'll come to whether or not that was an appropriate exercise or not in a moment. Take us back to the early 1970s, George. The ALP government of Gough Whitlam pushed through a remarkable set of reforms in its 3 years. How groundbreaking was this government and what did it achieve in a nutshell?
I think people would regard the Whitlam government as our most reformist government in history. And it came in 1972 on the back of 23 years of uninterrupted conservative rule. Quickly did things such as built relationships with China, which to that point were remarkable in global terms, introduced something that seems very strange today, that being no fees for university, major human rights reforms, recognition for women, a law reform agenda, which again is without parallel, and a series of other economic and other reforms down to the local government level. And these were bold, groundbreaking, controversial, and done within 3 years. So this was a barnstorming government that didn't last long. But even today, you can see the impact through Medicare, a range of policies that are felt quite deeply within the Australian system.
But at the same time, this government was also chaotic and prone to controversy, wasn't it?
It was, and severely criticised for its economic policies, for example. We've talked a lot about social policies, law reform, but there are real questions about whether the government was really grappling with the big economic questions at the time. It was a government that was mired in controversy. Lots of ministers were lost.
And there were a number of sort of harebrained schemes around government finance and what have you, weren't there?
There were, and you don't move this quickly, particularly when you don't control the Senate without taking some risks. And yet that included loans affairs, attempts to get funding from overseas, and all sorts of schemes that made people question, was this a sensible, moderate government? And of course, it wasn't moderate. It was bringing about quite bold, extraordinary reforms, but it did grapple with its own political success. It did, of course, win a second election in 1974, but these were narrow margins. And it was a government that in some ways was ahead of the popular opinion of the time.
So the government was always fragile because it never had, either in its first or second term, a majority in the Senate. What did that fragility mean? What did that lack of a majority in the Senate mean?
And of course, it's important to say that that's right. It had a clear majority in the lower house, but not the Senate. And that is the norm in Australian politics. There have been exceptions where the government has also controlled the Senate. The government of John Howard, for example, in the 2000s was an exception. But it meant in this case for Whitlam, as with most other prime ministers, that you're dependent upon the crossbench or the numbers in the Senate to get your budget through. So the basic expenditure of the day, and also get support for your bills. And one of the really surprising things about the Whitlam government was just how successful it was in bringing forward its law reform agendas, given it didn't actually control the upper house.
So what was the crisis in the lead up to the 11th of November 1975?
Well, the crisis was provoked by the unwillingness of the Senate to pass the government's budget bills in 1975. And these are, of course, the bills that provide expenditure for public servants, the ordinary functions of government. And if that bill doesn't pass, the government runs out of money. Salaries don't get paid, things grind to a halt. It's something perhaps we're a bit more familiar with now. We're in the middle of a shutdown in the United States. It's been running for some time, and the United States has had a number of shutdowns over the last couple of decades. But at this point in Australia, it was rarer. It was thought perhaps something that a deadlock that had to be resolved. And in the absence of that being resolved, we had a long period of time where there was real doubt about whether the government could pay its bills.
So in a moment, we'll come back to explore who acted appropriately or inappropriately or correctly or incorrectly. But what actually happened on the 11th of November, 1975?
Well, a series of events that shocked everyone. Whitlam had a routine meeting with his Governor General, Sir John Kerr, the Queen's representative. And at that meeting, Sir John Kerr said to Whitlam that he was terminating his commission as Prime Minister, sacking him as Prime Minister. Kerr explained his actions on the basis that Gough Whitlam needed to continue to have the support of the upper house. He needed the support to get those supply or budget bills passed. And because that hadn't happened, it was almost a vote of no confidence. And so he was right to dismiss Whitlam. And in that, Sir John Kerr was fortified by an advice from the Chief Justice of the High Court, Sir Garfield Barwick. So Whitlam was dismissed. Kerr then immediately brought Malcolm Fraser, the opposition leader, in to form a government.
And at what point was the public made aware of what had taken place? Was it on the steps of Parliament House?
Well, for almost everyone, yes. Of course, there were earlier events in Parliament itself, but the key event for most people would be that famous proclamation read by the Governor-General Secretary, David Smith, on the steps of Old Parliament House, declaring that the Whitlam government had been sacked.
And of course, Gough Whitlam standing there behind David Smith comes forward at the end of David Smith's announcement and he says the famous words.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor General.
Famous words that still resonate to this day.
So, George, Sir John Kerr, did he act appropriately and correctly? Did he exercise his reserve powers, in your view, correctly?
Well, and I'll give you my view, but let me preface it by saying that there's no concrete answer. And it says a lot about our legal and political system that I can't say, Damien, there's a clear right or wrong. It's not written into our constitution what the powers of the Governor General are. There's no mention of these reserve powers, certainly no mention of sacking a prime minister. In fact, the constitution doesn't even mention the prime minister. So we're dealing here with conventions, understandings of the system. But it's fair to say, going into 1975, that this was well outside of what people would have thought a Governor-General might have done, that a reserve power against the advice of the Prime Minister might have been used in this way. The last time anything like this occurred in the United Kingdom, you've got to go back to 1834. There's a Privy Council case in the 60s which said that this idea of sacking a Prime Minister is not within the scope of practical politics. Or in Canada around the same time, there was a suggestion that these reserve powers had become little more than a constitutional Cheshire cat. Nothing remained but their smiles. So by this point in the 70s, it wasn't really contemplated that this might occur. It was truly extraordinary. And in this case, it was really problematic because Kerr exercised this power to dismiss not because the Prime Minister lacked confidence of the lower house, which is the House of Government, but it's the Senate, which is not the House of Government, and of course typically is not controlled by the government of the day.
So, in your view, did Kerr act appropriately?
No, I don't think he did. I think this was a constitutional error of grand proportions. I don't think the reserve power exists and should not exist to enable a government of the day to be sacked because the Senate does not support their budget bill. If that were the case, it's frankly a knife to the throat of almost every Australian government. It would introduce such a massive level of instability. And in fact, the only reason we haven't gone back to 75 is self-restraint on the part of Senate since then. But if it's true, they have this power that they could use, which would simply force out a government of the day. But also, I think Kerr acted poorly as a Governor General. He did not warn Whitlam before making the decision. It did depend upon subterfuge in a way that was highly inappropriate. And I think this is not the sort of conduct that we want to see of a Governor General. If you've got to have the conversation, you do, but you don't ambush someone in this way. Even though Kerr would have said it was necessary because it would have led to a race to the palace, Whitlam would have tried and got Kerr sacked himself. That's not a good enough excuse for doing things in this way.
Before he was appointed Governor General, Sir John Kerr was the Chief Justice of New South Wales. So he had a deep knowledge of the Constitution. In your view, should that expertise have led him to a different choice?
Yes, I think so. And particularly coming from his eminent legal background, he immersed himself in politics and a political outcome in a way that a Governor General would be best to avoid. And we've got to remember here that if Kerr had not acted, there would have been a longer deadlock. The government may have shut down, but that would have provoked potentially a political solution, just as occurs regularly in the United States, that budget deadlocks can lead to political pain and that leads to an escalation of the need to resolve the matter. So there were other ways politically for this to have to be resolved. It didn't require the Governor General to step in. And it's a flaw in our democracy if a Governor General can sack a Prime Minister in these circumstances where the Prime Minister, as usual, lacks the support of an upper house.
Mm. In the lead up to November the 11th, the Governor General did seek advice from a number of High Court justices. Who did he seek advice from? And what do you think of those interactions? Were they appropriate? Were they correct?
I think it's wrong for High Court justices to advise a Governor General in circumstances where it could cast doubt on the independence of the High Court because of their engagement in political matters, or because it's possible that the matter itself might come before the High Court to be resolved. And in this case, it seems advice was provided by Sir Garfield Barwick, the Chief Justice of the Court, who himself had been a senior minister in a former Liberal Country Party government, which of course was then the opposition to Whitlam. And Sir Garfield Barwick provided a written advice in which he supported the outcome that the Governor General was taking, indicated it was constitutionally sound in terms of issues of supply and responsible government. And that was a key factor in fortifying the decision of Sir John Kerr in this case. And Kerr was clear about that. On the other hand, Sir Anthony Mason was also involved, a more junior High Court justice. Not so much as Sir Garfield Barwick. There was no written advice, though it appears he drafted a draft letter for Kerr that might have been used to dismiss Whitlam. And in Mason's case, it's less clear the full extent of his involvement. And since he has made clear that even though he recognises he did provide advice, he did not support Kerr's decision to proceed without Kerr notifying or warning Whitlam first.
And was it appropriate for the Governor General to speak to these judges? I understand that in terms of Sir Garfield Barwick, he actually at one point said to Whitlam, I'd like to get advice from the Chief Justice. And Whitlam said, no, don't.
And I think it was inappropriate in those circumstances for the Governor General to ask for the advice from High Court justices and inappropriate for High Court justices to provide the advice. And that's because we have a separation of powers. It's really very important that our judiciary is very separate from these political matters. And it's not inconceivable the court could have been asked to resolve these issues. In prior years, the court had already reached decisions on a clause of the Constitution that enabled the double dissolution of both houses of Parliament. That was the device used by Malcolm Fraser once Gough was sacked to call the election. So it's possible Gough might actually have challenged the calling of the double dissolution. And how would that have left the High Court with two of its justices unable to sit, including the Chief Justice. Maybe it would actually have altered the result by virtue of that. But ever since, it has also led people to question the independence of the court and to suggest that that was inappropriate, the court should stay clear of these matters. And I think contemporary practice would suggest very strongly that we would not see this again because of the damage that might again be done to the court.
Back in 2020, historian Jenny Hocking, after a lot of hard work, was instrumental in securing the release from the Australian National Archives of correspondence between the Governor-General and Buckingham Palace. George, what was revealed in those communications? And there are different interpretations about what was revealed.
That's right. And it had been questioned for a long time, what did the palace know? Did the Queen encourage Sir John Kerr to sack Gough Whitlam? Did she suggest the opposite? We just didn't know. And of course, these type of communications between Governors General and ultimately the person they're responsible to, the monarch, are deeply held secret in terms of the correspondence and what was said. But Jenny Hocking went through that Herculean battle, went through the courts, did manage to get access to these documents on the basis they're not personal papers, they're Commonwealth documents. And what they revealed is that, firstly, Sir John Kerr had not notified the palace before making the decision. He had certainly had discussions that indicated to the palace he was considering that, but he didn't go and ask permission. He didn't check whether it was correct or not. He essentially made the decision, and he was clear he made the decision without notifying in order to protect the Queen, recognising how she might have been drawn into controversy. But beyond that, it's also clear from those letters that there was correspondence, particularly with Charteris, who was the private secretary to the Queen, where there was correspondence recognising the existence of the reserve power, recognising a heavy responsibility in exercising them. And some would say that that was almost tacit encouragement, that given these were powers that elsewhere had been thought to have not existed, that they'd been gone for decades, if not a century or more in the United Kingdom, to not rule it out, but actually recognise their existence, well, perhaps that actually, in effect, egged Kerr on, gave him some confidence. So there are questions about that series of letters and whether, in fact, the palace should simply have warned Kerr away.
What about Malcolm Fraser, the leader of the opposition? He certainly played hardball politically in blocking supply, but more broadly, in your view, did he act appropriately?
I find it harder to criticise Malcolm Fraser. He essentially used the political levers at his disposal in order to overturn a government through the Governor-General, but it wasn't his decision to sack Gough Whitlam. That was Sir John Kerr. And Malcolm Fraser at all times acted in ways consistent with his political interest. It's what you expect a politician and a political system to do, but it's also why you have Governor-Generals and rules to ensure that it can't occur in this case. So I think Fraser rightly has been seen as Machiavellian, unscrupulous, and determined to gain power at almost any cost. But I tell you what, you could say a lot of that about a lot of prime ministers in Australia. I think in this case, he took advantage of a Governor General who made the wrong decision and was able to manipulate the outcome to his advantage. But of course, that was to his expected political advantage.
You're listening to The Law Report. Today we're marking the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam by his Governor-General, Sir John Kerr. Damien Carrick with you, and I'm speaking with Professor George Williams. He's Vice-Chancellor of the University of Western Sydney, and he's one of Australia's leading constitutional law experts. George, so far we've been talking about whether other people could have acted differently in the circumstances. What about Gough Whitlam? Did he ignore some pretty clear warning signs?
There are indications that yes, that is the case, that Gough didn't read the room, didn't read where Sir John Kerr was, that this trigger might be pulled. I mean, in Gough's defence, perhaps nobody thought it was that likely it would have occurred. This was so constitutionally exceptional and outside of the realm of known possibility at that point, even though we had a state government sacked in 1932. So
in New South Wales?
In New South Wales. It had happened 40 or more years before, but that was seen as exceptional, unusual, and very different circumstances where the government was sacked for arguably breaching the law, for acting illegally. This was a very different case. But it suggested in this case that perhaps Whitlam just didn't understand his Governor General as well as he might, that he didn't understand his motivations, that the discussions should have given rise to this. So I think there's an issue about empathy and understanding, but it is also the case that this was deeply shocking to Whitlam, because as someone who believed deeply in our institutions, in the Westminster system of government, This was just not within his realm of possibility. And, of course, until it happened, I think most people thought he would have been right.
So he's effectively sacked on the 11th of November 1975. And then there's an election in December of that year, and it's a really comprehensive victory for Malcolm Fraser and the Liberal and the Country Party. They get a majority in both houses, don't they?
They do. A landslide election, so Fraser wins, and of course at that point doesn't have the same problem as the government that was deposed because of his support in the Senate. And there are questions about, well, even if I think, for example, and others think Sir John Kerr got it right, does the election cure that? Do we have a system where democracy, in essence, is the ultimate arbiter? And there are some who would say that is the case. That was a vindication of the decision. I don't see it that way because I think, well, people cast their judgment on political grounds, but it doesn't justify what I think should be seen as an unconstitutional action, particularly given the danger and flaw that exposes in our system of government.
Danger and flaw in our system of government. That's what you would say is the take-home lesson of the 1975 dismissal. Nobody acted illegally, just they acted within the spaces, the empty spaces, within the constitutional framework.
And because we have a constitution where many of the most important rules are not written down. And the constitution itself says nothing about conventions, the role of the prime minister. It's assumed through those conventions the Governor-General will act on the advice of the Prime Minister, except in these really rare circumstances of reserve powers. But those reserve powers have never been defined. So we have the Queen or King's representative with this awesome and important role, but real doubt and uncertainty as to how far that role extends, and in particular, when they can sack the government of the day. I mean, that to me doesn't sound like a sensible or stable system, but it's one that worked until 1975 because people just didn't contemplate that that reserve power could be exercised with the government of the day, couldn't get its budget bill through. When it became clear that was possible with Kerr, and it's normal that governments don't have that upper house majority, that's the flaw. That's the issue that remains in our system, that until fixed, we just can't guarantee that we won't have a repeat of something like 1975.
Have there been any attempts to change Australia's constitution or reserve powers in the subsequent 50 years?
There have been attempts. The best example would be the Republic referendum in 1999, where we voted on do we move to a president. But interestingly, there was such contention, even in 99, a couple of decades after the dismissal of 75, that it was not thought possible to resolve this issue, what the reserve powers say, whether it's reasonable to sack a prime minister where a budget bill's been denied by the Senate or failed to pass. And so they fudged it. In that referendum in 99, they simply kept the reserve powers as they are without seeking to resolve this issue.
Fascinatingly, after many years of giving each other the cold shoulder, Whitlam and Fraser had gone on to bury the hatchet and they campaigned together in 1999, both in support of the Republic. What does that tell you about Australia's politics and Australia's constitutional framework?
It tells us a lot of good things, I think. And I remember I had the great privilege of speaking to both of them at different times about these incidents, and in fact appeared at a couple of events with both of them in the 90s where they had reconciled and I think come to terms with those events. I think it says something wonderful about our capacity for forgiveness on the part of Gough. I think it also says a lot about Malcolm Fraser's extraordinary character, that he was able to move on and forge a relationship after those events. So I think even though I've described this as the greatest political and constitutional crisis in our history, it's a wonderful thing that those personal relationships were repaired and that these two quite extraordinary men were actually able to find common ground, even though it was many years later.
Mm. Sir John Kerr didn't have quite the happy embrace and reconciliation with either side of politics, did he?
No, he didn't. And to this day, he remains the primary villain. I mean, the architect of the Fraser government. And it's why in my case as well, I would say Sir John Kerr is the one who would bear the primary responsibility for that crisis.
He was shunned by the left, but not really supported or celebrated by the Conservatives either, to whom he gave the keys to the lodge.
That's right. And on both sides, he lacked his supporters. And of course, for the Fraser government, it also brought in questions about the legitimacy of its own government as well. Perhaps if we hadn't had the dismissal, the Fraser government would have handsomely won the forthcoming election, without these issues about whether there'd been this illegal coup to remove the Whitlam government. So it did introduce a range of problems for the right of politics, as well, of course, for the dismissal of the left. And Sir Kerr, being at the centre of it, sought to justify himself on multiple occasions. But I think of all of the players, history would judge him as the least convincing.
I've got to ask, George, following 1975, when PMs are considering appointing someone as Governor General, do they or one of their colleagues sit down and have a really frank conversation with them? What would you do in the circumstances of 1975 if they were repeated? How do you understand your role? Do you think these conversations are happening?
I doubt they would be as overt as that. It's a bit like when you appoint High Court judges. You want enough of an indication as to their character, their values, how they would approach a crisis situation, but you'd be wary about asking so directly about a matter of this kind. It may have happened, but not to my knowledge. But you can be assured that, yes, before appointing any Governor General now or in the years after 1975, that governments will be alive to this issue and will be well aware that it remains possible that a Prime Minister can be deposed in Australia where a Senate, where they don't control the numbers, decides not to pass their budget bill. So in those circumstances, you'll be very careful about your selection and you'll be very careful to make sure that they are a person of the character, the values, and also the judgment. A cool head in a crisis is what you'll be looking for.
George, 50 years on, how do you reflect on the impact of the dismissal on our country and on our government, on our way we rule ourselves, on our way the government functions in Australia?
I think the first thing I would say is it's a good thing. It is a one-off, even though this could have happened again in the 50 years since it hasn't, but it remains here as a possibility. It also says a lot, though, about our incapacity to fix this problem. This is a deep problem within our system that does need to be resolved to provide security, confidence, good governance. We should know what the powers of the Governor General are. We should know how they would act again in a circumstance like this. It says much that we had a referendums in 1977, but none since have passed. So we're coming up to nearly the half century of our last successful referendum from 1977. And it is unfortunate that as a nation, we've let this sit and never grappled with the longer term reforms that are needed.
And you would need a referendum to solve the issue, to solve the tension?
You could have a political agreement, which we have at the moment, a tacit political agreement based upon self-restraint. But we know, particularly in this world, in this Trumpian world, that it's unwise to rely just upon self-restraint and what people think is the proper thing to do within a democratic system. So to fix this in the way it should be fixed, well, yes, you would need to change the Constitution. You would need to spell out what the Governor-General is there for, their powers. You'd codify the powers in a sensible way. That's been done and can be done in other contexts, but it would, to do so, require us to grapple with what are those powers and potentially answer the question, did Sir John Kerr get it right? Does this reserve power exist? Should we write it into the Constitution? And it says a lot half a century later that we're still seemingly unable to resolve whether Kerr got it right or not in order to actually properly grapple with that reform question.
Professor George Williams, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Western Sydney, one of Australia's leading constitutional law experts. Wonderful talking to you on this anniversary of the dismissal of the Whitlam government by Sir John Kerr.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Cucoglia and also to audio producer this week, Ross Richardson. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.